Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It is always just a little joy for me when you show up and sit down for some time here at the podcast. I'm really excited about the conversation we're going to have today because it's a brother I've gotten to know over the last few years, and he brings his A game every time. He's committed, even though he's left the Republican Party. I'll forgive him. But he's none other than Kurt Bardella, creator and publisher of the country music media platform, The Morning Hangover, as well as a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors and an NBC News Think, LA Times, and USA Today contributor. You get to see him on our air at MSNBC from time to time, and is president of Endeavor Strategies and founded the firm following a long career in the U.S. Congress, where then he was the senior advisor, spokesman, and deputy communications director for the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform in the majority, I might add. And its chairman, Representative Daryl Issa from California. He was the communications director for Bill Bray from California, and press secretary for Senator Olympia Snow, one of my favorites. I love Olympia. Mm-hmm. I work with her now on the Bipartisan Policy Board.
Yeah.
She's a great, great lady. He's been named one of Washington's 50 people to watch by Politico and top 35 under 35 by the DC Republican Party. Kurt, welcome to the podcast, baby.
Thanks for having me on, brother.
Man, you're looking good, man. You're looking good. I know you've been out there slinging it every day, trying to keep people honest and just, you know, tell the truth as it is. So before we get into current events, I really like people to get a sort of a feel for your walk. I mean, when we have a guest on, I like for folks to kind of get a sense of, okay, what makes this brother tick? What makes him who he is? Why does he think the way he thinks? And why did he just say what he said? You know? You try to anticipate some of that. You were a Republican probably from very early on in your professional mm-hmm. life. Recently left the party because of its tilt towards Trumpism and its move away from a lot of the values that helped define you and the party mm-hmm. at that time. So what was it? What was it about your journey to the party that kind of brought you in the room?
Yeah.
And what was it inside the room that ultimately made you go, oh, the hell with this?
No, you're right. I became a Republican right out of high school. I was 17 years old. And it was...
We were the same age. Many years before, but the same age.
So for me, it was 2001. But
yeah, it was 1976.
So, a little different. But I had the opportunity to work for a member of the California State Legislature right out of high school, and it's been like I didn't really know the differences between the two parties that well. But I had the opportunity to work for this guy and get a foot in the hole of politics. It was right after 9/11, and so. I think for me, part of being a Republican and having at that time a Republican administration, I almost associated to being patriotic almost.
Yeah.
And as we had our response to 9/11 and the subsequent war on terror, the rhetoric of the party talking about protecting our country and our values, spoke to me. And when I got to Washington a few years later. Had the opportunity, as you referenced, to work at the Oversight Committee. Our work there was about check and balance and accountability and transparency to the American people and making sure that the instruments of government were working as effectively and efficiently as possible for the American people. And I believe that then, and I believe in that now. Mm-hmm. And you fast forward to where we are now, and this is a party that has abandoned the ideas of oversight and transparency. We saw Republicans give Donald Trump a four-year walk, basically, to do whatever he wanted, to completely destroy the barriers of separation of powers, to ignore congressional subpoenas, to use the instruments of government for corruptive practices. And even more so as time went on, I began to see how the party really became, in my opinion, a vehicle to harness white nationalism in America, and started defending and using coded words and racist language and things that we even saw last year, like the China virus and the Kung Flu. And for me, it's like, I can't be a part of a party that does stuff like that.
Yeah, so you've picked at a couple of scabs there, and you know, being the Johns Hopkins biology major that I once was, let's take a scalpel to that. On that last point, what do you think was there, either originally or crept into the soul of the party that moved it towards this sort of white nationalism embrace of this level of just ignorant, dumbass mm-hmm. hatred,
right?
You know, as espoused by the likes of Senator Ron Johnson recently, when he was like, mm-hmm. "Oh yeah, all those white people committing insurrection, I'm not afraid of them." It's the guy who's down on you know, Pennsylvania Avenue, screaming about, you know, justice and so mm-hmm. forth, or quite honestly, you know, the Asian individual over there who's getting beat right. up. I'm less concerned about their interest. In fact, I may be more afraid of them. What the hell's happened? What now? I liken it back to the you know, the 1960s and the Southern strategy and the embrace of sort of that effort to get mm-hmm. white men, Southern white men in particular, to vote inside the party, because it was a strategy to win the White House. Is how we right. can win nationally. But I think it's maybe a little bit more than that. I don't know. What from your experience, having served on the committee and been inside those rooms, what did you hear and see that kind of made you go, that doesn't sound right?
You know, I really think it shifted pretty dramatically. Around 2014 is when I really noticed a big difference. Mm-hmm. And part of that coincided with the rise of the quote unquote Tea Party, which I think was the precursor to Trumpism. And that it became less about substantive public policy and more about almost kind of fighting this culture war. And it became less about, we need to secure the border because we have very real threats that our country needs to address, whether it was back in the 2000s, the war on terror, whether right. it's, you know, the very legitimate issue of drug cartels, which is a real issue. Having lived in San Diego, a border town my whole life, I can tell you that's a real issue. But it became less about that and more about, they're coming here to take stuff from us. They're invading us. They're coming here to take things away from white people. And the conversation began to really shift very dramatically. And I think about one of the big culminating moments, in my opinion, of the shift of the Republican Party happened in that 2014 cycle, when an unknown guy named Dave Brat beat the sitting House Majority Leader, right, Eric Cantor,
right.
And he ran solely on the issue of immigration and demonizing brown people in America and trying to create the impression that the Eric Cantors of the world, and Eric being a pretty conservative guy, I think we would all agree, right?
Right, right.
That Eric Cantor was selling out America's interests to give backdoor amnesty to brown people. And it's like, that's the issue that took the House Majority Leader down. And Dave Brat's campaign, that was Trump before Trump. That was build the wall before there was any of that.
Right.
And after that, I think there was just this kind of, first of all, nonsense candidates began to see, oh, we can win. If we just actually double down on crazy, we can win a primary. We feel like, oh, who knew? Like, we spent right. the whole time thinking we had to hide the crazy. It turns out if we just turn up the volume, we can win. And we started seeing more of that.
Right.
And the people that used to be considered the fringe of our party, the Michelle Bachmans, the Louis Gohmerts, the, you know, the Steve Kings, well, they started becoming even more visible and vocal because they saw, oh, wait, I can say these crazy things and I'm going to get attention. I'm going to grow a following. I'm getting visibility and more influence. And it culminated with what we saw in 2016 with the election of Donald Trump. But that's really where I saw this big change happen in the party.
Well, you and while you were talking, I wanted to pull up, I think sort of for folks, a clarifying narrative from you in a USA Today story back in December of 2017. You wrote, "Roy Moore is the last straw. You can now call me a Democrat." And in that, you went on to cite, you know, Lewandowski and his physical altercation with a Breitbart reporter, Michelle Fields. And then you began to sort of tick off these narratives. And you talk about the fact that the Republican National Committee, the president at the time, supporting and funding Moore, who had allegations of literally, you know,
picking up teenagers at the local mall.
Yeah, picking up teenagers at the local mall, you know, just the whole, just the so sexual predator narrative with underage girls. And you said, "This is not my party. This is not a party I want to be associated with any longer. This is not a party that is trustworthy enough to protect innocent children from sexual predators." And everyone has that point for them where they draw the line. And I find myself at times cheating on those lines because it's part of my nature. It's like, okay, I guess it's part of being Catholic. You're always looking, okay, I'm going to try to forgive you and give you one more shot at, you know, redemption. And then, okay, you disappoint, but okay, one more time, you know. But you drew that line. How do you feel now that you've drawn that line and you're on the other side, you're in the Democratic Party? Clearly, those ideological and maybe even philosophical lines for you are still there. I mean, you didn't leave because you suddenly now embrace a progressive, a liberal, or democratic agenda, you know, in terms of politics and policy. Mm-hmm. But it was something a little bit more for you. What, help us understand what that was and how that line was drawn, particularly around this incident.
No, I think that before you even get to issues of public policy and conventional ideology, there has to be just a fundamental basic moral compass that, frankly, we should all agree on. Right. Like, we should all be able to agree that electing a sexual predator is probably a bad idea. Right. You know,
like, I think we can all agree on that.
It's like this should be common ground stuff here, you know, and even looking more recently, we should all agree that trying to violently overthrow the government and stop the electoral process is something that we should oppose and abhor. And when we get to a point where those things aren't aligned anymore, or those things actually have become partisan somehow, it doesn't matter what you think about education policy or climate change or taxation in this country. If we can't even get on the same page about just how our democracy should function,
right,
and what kind of people should participate in that democracy, that's a real freaking problem right there.
Right.
And to me, the biggest divide between Democrats and Republicans right now is, and you kind of touched on it earlier, it's that Senator Ron Johnson views the world in a way in which white people who are literally murdering Capitol police don't provoke fear in him. But Black people down the street at Black Lives Matter Plaza who are peacefully assembling and protesting social justice in America, that scares him. Like that's the schism right there. And that's why, for me, I look back now on my decision to lead the Republican Party, and I feel very comfortable with that decision.
So a lot of that has been and serves as a backdrop for the events that I want to move into now, because as noted in an opinion piece by Helene Olin for the Washington Post, entitled "What Connects America's Mass Shootings? Easy Access to Guns." Mm-hmm. I don't want so much focus on the gun portion of her piece, but I do want to start with her opening, which was, "On Tuesday afternoon, a gunman walked into multiple spas in Georgia and opened fire with a handgun. He killed 8 people, 7 of them women, 6 of whom were of Asian descent. His motive is unclear, but the event bears all the hallmarks of a hate crime against both Asians and women." What's your assessment there of what happened in Atlanta? And just as an update, we're reeling now with the killing of 10 individuals
Colorado.
Colorado, as a young man goes in to a store and shoots and kills a police officer and someone as young as 20 years old. And so the police are now still sorting that out, but staying focused on Georgia, how do you see that as an Asian American? You and I were kind of laughing before we came on and talking about when these things happen in our communities, the networks are scrambling to find an Asian or a Black person to put on the air to talk about them, which says a lot about the fact that they've got to go scramble to find some folks, number one. But number two, everybody wants to jump to a certain conclusion or to create a narrative before police have finished their investigation or the evidence gives us a clarity on as to what really not only happened, but what the motivations of the assailant were. How do you assess it at this point, given the very delicate nature of the attack, the impact on your community, which I will align myself with as an American, say our community, but nonetheless, specifically within the Asian community, how do you see it? How are you reading it?
You know, part of what happened in Atlanta, I think people need to understand the context here. There has been a 150% increase in hate crimes against Asian Americans since March of 2020. For the better part of a year.
March of 2020.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, for the better part of a year, we had the most powerful person in the world with the biggest microphone use phrases like China virus and Kung flu. And there is a direct correlation with that rhetoric and the escalating violence against Asian Americans. We're seeing in recent weeks anecdotes from coast to coast of people who are just walking down the street. Asian Americans are getting beat. There is an elderly man who got sliced with box cutters across his face. There are people who are eating out at restaurants who are getting spit on and called China virus. Go back to China. You did this, on and on and on and on. And so with that happening, there comes this event in Atlanta where not one, not two, but three Asian spas are the sites of shootings. And even if the person who did the shooting has never uttered an Asian racist slur in his life, the fact that you went to three Asian American spas, one literally called it Asia Spa,
right.
inherently tells me that there is a race component there. And it may not be as obvious as some would like it to be to talk about this comfortably, but to Asian Americans, we see the pattern. We see that, well, on some level, there was the sexualization of Asian women that led you to these places. You know, there was a disregard for life, particularly associated with the Asian American community, that made you feel like this was an appropriate venue for you to lash out, we'll call it.
Right.
There is a lack of trust fundamentally in law enforcement in general. And so we're not inclined to start to wait for them to put their interpretation on what happened, because we saw a sheriff spokesperson had a press conference, referred to the shooter as a victim having a bad day. It turns out this spokesperson has social media posts of him posting racist shit against Asian Americans.
Wow. Like, yep.
How are we supposed to listen to what you have to say and trust that a racist isn't going to find a racism in the motivation? You know, it's like, that's part of the issue here. Really, in the shooting, there were a couple of things that converged. The issue of gun violence overall. It's like, we forget, because we've all been quarantined away for the better part of a year, that before that happened, before COVID, mass shootings were a very big problem in this country.
Yeah.
School shootings were a big problem in this country. That didn't magically go away just because we've been sheltering in place for a little bit of time. And as things have opened up now, we're seeing back-to-back mass shootings
coming back,
less than a week apart. So the issue of gun violence, the issue of racism, the issue of hate crimes, the reality that overall our law enforcement institutions aren't even set up to adequately police hate crimes anyway. Our criminal justice system isn't set up to sufficiently prosecute hate crimes. The majority of hate crimes in this country go unreported, whether it's African-Americans, Latinos, Asian-Americans, that across the cultural divide is true, because all of us know that the people that we would be reporting these to are harboring racist people, frankly. I mean, you look at just the Capitol insurrection, one in six of the people who have been arrested so far have a law enforcement background.
I know. And that part to me, going back to what you said about the police chief and his pronouncement of at least victimhood, if not to some degree, understanding and you know, innocence for this poor guy who's having a problem with his sexual proclivities. Yeah, so you drive by all the white-owned spa and social parlors to find the ones that are specifically, because he drove something like 240 some miles. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like this brother went around the corner and stayed in the neighborhood. No, he drove specifically to sites. Now, I had somebody say, well, those probably are places that he's frequented in the past. I'm like, nice try.
Because that's just a big radius. 200
that's
miles.
A big ass radius to just kind of go, I'm going to drive 500 miles for a massage. Seriously? Round trip? No. Yeah. So we get where that's going. But it does raise a very interesting conversation point for me that I think states, counties, municipalities, and obviously federal officials such as Capitol Hill Police and others need to take a close look at who they got carrying a gun for them.
Yep.
Who they have out there with the badge on, because as more and more evidence is coming to the table from the research of scientists and others, you know, social scientists who are tracking these things, we're now discovering that, you know, it says a lot when you're talking one out of six of our police officers, two out of 10 or whatever the number is. If it's more than one, it's a problem in my book.
Yeah.
Are affiliated, aligned with that white supremacy, white nationalist mindset, and who are living out in some cases their fantasies about how to deal with people like you and me when they encounter us, using that badge as their shield.
Yeah. I mean, and again, that's like, how are we supposed to feel safe? How are we supposed to trust a system that time and again has failed all of us over and over and over again, and now to the point where it's so widely known and accepted in law enforcement that they share these prejudices that they actually feel comfortable posting on social media these things.
Yes, I mean that.
It's like
they're not even
trying to hide it.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. So anybody who's sitting up there going, oh, you know, you're going on and on about the police. I support the police. Have members in my family. That's not the point. The point is to what Kurt just said. Call me crazy, but look, they're posting this stuff. I'm not the one, I'm not making it up. They're telling us they feel bold and brazen enough to actually say, Hitler, okay, you know, KKK, nice party. You know, yeah. I mean, just come on. It's just, what more do you evidence? What more do you want to say that you have a problem here that absolutely needs to get addressed? And it makes, to your point, I think, Kurt, it hard for reasonable public officials and community leaders and activists, leaders like yourself to deal with the hate that is now being displayed and used against Asians in this country. Because how do I know the person I'm sitting to isn't, you know, when we're done this conversation, going online and posting, you wouldn't believe, you know, the conversation I had with this slur, so that's the problem. If you can't trust the people in the process, where do you go? What do you do?
Right. And I think that's why, you know, I go back to what, Reverend Al Sharpton, one of his famous, slogan, no justice, no peace.
Right.
And I think, that's that feeling of, if you're not going to level the playing field, if we are not going to systemically institute the reforms we need so that we can all have equal stake and trust in the system, okay, then we're going to get very loud. We're going to get in your face about it, and we're not going to go away. And I think that one of the things that was so instructive, I think, for the Asian American community as we're going through this moment was watching how the Black Lives Matter movement came to be and organize and how effective it has mm-hmm. become. And I, for one, am so grateful that we have that movement to look back and see that's how you mobilize. That's how you shape a national conversation. That's how you even just get attention. I think one of the challenges for the Asian American community has always been fighting the what we call the model minority myth, that stereotype that we're polite, that we're quiet, that we're not right. the ones yelling. And now we're at a point, I think, where we're ready to say, all right, we're done with that. Like, we're done playing in that construct. We can be loud. We can get angry, and we have every right to feel angry.
Have you found any support? Has the Asian community, either on a small scale or national scale, small, I mean, locally community mm-hmm. oriented versus national, support and reinforcement, if you will, from other agencies, not in a federal sense, but, you know, institutions and groups
yeah.
That are like Black Lives Matters and others coming, mm-hmm. saying, no, we're standing with you on this issue. Your fight is our fight, kind of.
Yeah, narrative. That's been one of the real heartening, actually, things about all of this is, you know, there's been a movement that started and you know, is hashtag Stop Asian Hate. And from that, we have seen a coalition of a very broad coalition form where the NAACP has been a very vocal partner mm-hmm. in advancing that message. You know, I think of something the Rev said the other day. We were on MSNBC together, and he said, you know, we can't fight hate against everyone if we allow hate against anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and hate against you is harmful to me as well.
Right.
You know, and we like all
if they hate you now, they'll hate me tomorrow. So
right,
don't think you're going to get away from this.
That's exactly it. It's like, you know, first they came for the African-Americans, then they came for the Latinos. Now they've come for the Asian Americans. It's right. they if you are not white, they see you all in the same color on some level. Right. And so I think this has been a real important moment where there have historically been tensions between all the different communities, sure. Asian Americans, African Americans, Latinos. You know, I think back to during the Rodney King riots, there was a lot of tension between the African American community and the Korean community.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And I think it's been very healing, though, to see that the idea that if we address hate over here, it takes away from addressing hate over there. That's a construct created by white people to say there's only so much pieces of the pie. Here's your little piece of the pie.
Right.
So if homeboy over here takes that piece, that's your problem, not ours. We're done with it. We're saying, no. We want the whole pie.
Right.
And we're going to fight together for that. And that's been really heartening. So there was over the weekend, a great rally in New York mm-hmm. of Black leaders and Asian American leaders coming together to protest what's going on. And that, you know, and I think this is the first time that I can say in my lifetime that that's happened, that we're having all of these groups unite.
Well, I think you make a good point referencing the Rodney King narrative, because that was one of those situations that goes back to what I was saying, where a lot of Blacks felt that they were isolated and alone. And, you know, we know now that there was some stirring of that pot internally, sort of create this tension right. between Blacks and Asians.
We got played.
You got played.
Yeah.
And it goes to the point I was making before. You got played to the point where you thought at the time, well, they'll never come for us. They like us. Mm-hmm. We know they don't like you, but they like us. And then you realize, no, they don't.
Nah.
They don't like you either. Just ask the Native Americans. No, it don't work like that.
That's right.
So we're having a great conversation with my buddy Kurt Bardella. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have a little bit more on this, but how it also now seems the ball has been moved by the president himself in a very important narrative around gun laws in this country. We'll be back with more right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. Appreciate having you in the house for this conversation with my buddy Kurt Bardella. who is, you know, just this country music media guru, which we're going to get into that a little bit, because this Asian brother can blow down on some country music. You cannot best him in this genre, folks. Don't even try. And his network and connections there are amazing. But we're going to get into that in a little bit. The word breaking in the last literally 8 or so hours is the president of the United States, after spending some time on the ground in Georgia, and now, of course, on the heels of the shootings in Colorado, has come out with a very, very strong statement around gun control, gun laws in this country, where he's calling for a ban on assault weapons. He's wanting the Congress to move to where the American people are. You and I know this is at this a 90% issue with the American people. And that includes NRA members, Republicans, center right independents, who want the government, wants our leaders to begin to address the level of gun violence in this country. As you rightly noted, we are just now creeping our heads out from under the weight of COVID-19. And literally, folks, within 24, 36 hours, we have 2 mass shootings in different parts of this country. What do you think about what the president is looking to do here? Are we barking up that same tree? And again, what's your take, Kurt, and how this narrative looks and plays out?
You know, I had said, gosh, sometime before the president even announced he was going to run as a candidate, that one of the reasons why he was such an appealing candidate to me was because we were going to have tragic events like this happen right. repeatedly. And I thought that through his own life story, and nobody understands grief like Joe Biden does. Right. And that's what makes him such an effective communicator and playing that role of consoler in chief at times. And I'm heartened to hear him now connect that, you know, that ability to empathize with action. And, you know, I feel as a Democrat here, if we can't get this done right now, having the White House, having a Senate and a House, I don't care how slim the majority is, the American people have given Democrats the reins of power. If you cannot exercise them effectively to do something that more than 70% of Americans agree with.
Right.
This isn't controversial. This isn't even, in my opinion, partisan outside of, you know, the Capitol. Most people in this country want more universal background checks. Most people in this country support banning weapons of war. Most people support having waiting periods and closing gun show loopholes. And if they can't get this done right now, I don't know what the hell they're doing, honestly. And this is going to be, I think, a very instructive exercise at how effective this presidency and the Democrats in general are going to be, because they made the case for 4 years now. Give us the reins of power. We will get shit done. This is the put up or shut up moment for them.
Yeah, no, it is. I agree with you there. It is very much a put up or shut up moment. We're either going to begin to tackle this thing as part of the healing narrative that the president has put in front of us. So it's not just healing from COVID. It's not just healing the economy. It's not just dealing with the racial strife around the Asian and Black communities in this country. It is also dealing with the thing that is killing more of us on an annual basis than anything else. Right. And so, look, I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I always have been. I'm not now a gun owner. I very well may be in about 20 minutes.
you and me both.
Given the way some of these white folks are behaving out here, somebody's going to have to look after my house and my family.
Amen.
But the reality of it is, This is not, let's not get caught up in the bullshit argument that someone's looking to take away your guns. No, that's not what this is about. We're looking to put in place a common sense resolution to the fact that people are dying at the hands of people who may be suffering mental illness, the hands of people who are criminals, the hands of people who, for whatever reason, had a bad day. We have to look at the processes that are in place that allow that to happen. And then correct for them. I mean, it does substitute out guns and put in some other subject matter and ask yourselves, would you allow it to get that bad?
Right. I mean, the guy in Georgia bought the gun the day that he used it. Like, how is it possible that it's easier to get a gun in Georgia than the vote?
Thank you.
I mean,
and like, you got all those numbnut Republicans right now trying to roll back the vote on black people. Y'all better let them black folks get some vote and some guns, because
that's right.
You know, I mean, but you want to go out there. But the point is, look, you just find ourselves in a situation, Kurt, where we're not dealing with the issue in an honest and forthright way. You've got people who want to demagogue. You got people who want to grift off of it. You got people who want to fundraise off of it. You got people who want to do all kinds of things except deal with the fact that Americans are killing each other, and that we are seemingly doing nothing about it. And that's not okay. It's not okay when 10 people who are just in a grocery store minding their business, or 8 people who are just, you know, carrying on as a business owner or a worker or even a customer in a store, have to worry about, gee, is this the last moment I have on this earth because some guy who can't seem to get himself together sexually wants to come in and blame the Asian community for that? Right. Or some other guy who, for whatever reasons, can't seem to get his life together, wants to go into a store and start using people as target practice. I don't know. I don't know what I'm missing here. I don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, if you were to step outside of this issue and, like I said, replace it with any other thing, if any other thing was causing this type of mayhem, violence, uncertainty, threatening our children, we would do something about
we
that.
We do something, yes.
You know, I mean, you know, just even at the micro level, any parent, you know, if something was happening that was threatening your child, you would damn sure do something about that. And I can't fully understand why, as a country and as political leaders, that can't happen too, because it's so common sense, you know. And the idea that, oh, they're coming for your guns, they're just shredding the site, like that's such nonsense. I mean, that is an idiotic and dumb man's response.
Well, how the hell will they come for your guns when there are only 330 million men, women, and children in the country, and over 400 million guns in the hands of those individuals? So for someone like me who don't own a gun, that means somebody's got my gun several times over, right?
That's right.
So this idea that they're coming to get your steel, to take your weapons from you, is just BS. And people just need to get away from that line of thinking. Regulating the use of weapons, sort of putting in appropriate controls for access to those weapons, is not the same as not allowing you to own a gun or coming in and taking what you already own from you. Look, you're required to register by law. You're required to take a test to use a firearm, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's not like this is an absolute, you just walk into a store, hey, I'll take the Smith & Wesson, the 3 Uzis, and a pack of cigarettes. I mean, that's just not how this works. So why do we act like that's how it works?
Right.
It's crazy.
I mean, it's no different than, I mean, we require you, if you want to drive a vehicle, to go through a process to show that you can do so confidently and safely. And if you actually have a mental condition of some kind, the threshold to be able to do that is much higher, as well it should be. You know,
it's common sense. You don't get a license if you don't have the correct eye vision. Okay.
Right.
They make you go get a pair of glasses. All right. And if you don't want to wear glasses, you don't get the driver's license. this is not complicated. It just nope. isn't, you know? I mean, so if the government can do that.
Right. And, you know, and track every car in America. We know where it is.
We know who owns it.
Yes. We know who's responsible for it. Like, it's insured. I mean,
they know the tracker in the car when they assemble it. I'm just like, come on. What are you talking about? It's enough to make you drink. I swear. It really is.
Why do you think I listen to country music so much?
You working me there, baby. We're getting close. One last business question before we get into the fun stuff. What's your assessment right now of this administration? We're about 70 some days in or so, maybe more. Where do you see things right now? You've got the success of the COVID bill getting out there and done, but you've got some opportunities down the road, maybe with infrastructure, but then you've got problems with filibuster.
Yeah.
So how are you assessing things right now?
You know, I think that the first, second, and third job of this administration was to administer the vaccine,
right?
Create a plan and distribution network that would reach the most Americans and get the most shot in arms, and to give us light at the end of the tunnel, the COVID tunnel. And they have done that. And they have done that, in my opinion, ahead of schedule. They have overachieved, in my opinion, on that. The other thing, getting relief and something in place to help shore up the economy and give the American people a second lease on life to make it to that end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. They did that. And in my opinion, they overachieved on that as well. I think at times we forget, because of the COVID crisis, that there was a lot of other bad stuff going on for 4 years that have created tensions and crises that are now popping their heads up. You know, it is no small feat when you have to deal with COVID, the economy, a border situation, a racial situation, mm-hmm. a school situation, and a gun violence situation. Those are six things. Any one of those by themselves could consume an entire presidency. Right? This yes. president's got six of them going on simultaneously. That is an almost impossible situation to navigate. And I think that, you know, we've had kind of a 2 month, what we would call, I guess, a honeymoon, right?
Right.
The honeymoon came to a crashing halt, this last week, in my opinion, with the convergence of gun violence, hate crimes, and situation at the border. And yeah, that's kind of, I think, the state of play for the White House.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Everybody kind of waits for this sort of, you know, it's almost like a denouement, you know, that kind of ending to this 100-day period. And then we get to safely sit back and assess, okay, so do you get a passing grade on this? Or do you get a... and yet, I think that the events of this past week, for sure, coupled with the stark realities of the full nature of the partisanship in the country, and certainly in the Congress, really has kind of jolted Joe, if you will, in a way that other presidents have not been. You have, for example, George Bush being hit with the reality of suddenly 9/11, but that was eight, mm-hmm. 9 months after, you know, he assumed office. It wasn't something he walked in the door having to deal with. It's not like he didn't have a transition, unlike Joe Biden, who didn't have a transition.
Right.
He had to step into that space and sort of create a foundation at the same time, staving off the blows that were coming. So I think the way you put that is very, very well put, that, you know, he's kind of, you know, now having to, you know, the reality is now he's not really, there has been no honeymoon for him. Mm-hmm. He literally had to hit the ground doing stuff that otherwise could have been done or should have been done earlier, or at least given him more runway to do it.
And not to mention, just 2 weeks before he was even sworn in, there was a massive insurrection attempt on our Capitol.
Well,
I mean,
just to top it all off, you know. You know, what are you going to do on a Tuesday, right, or a Wednesday?
Oh my gosh,
it's crazy, man! I tell you, it is one of those things that I sit there and I just shake my head at times as I listen to people talk about January 6th on the Republican side as if it was just, some liberty, God-loving, sort of God-fearing, flag-loving moment. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? Yeah. And why would you even think that, knowing what you know, and especially given what you at least pretend about, protecting this nation and our freedoms and our liberties, and yet you don't see people coming to the Capitol with weapons, breaking the windows and looking to execute the president, the vice president and the speaker of the House as a problem. You don't have a problem with that?
It's scary when you look at the video and the timing now, and we know so much more of, like, these guys were seconds away from getting their hands on some of these people.
Yes.
I mean, Mitt Romney almost walked down a corridor that led right to them, if not for a Capitol Police officer redirecting him. It's like, if that doesn't jar you into reality, I don't know what does, man. Like,
I agree with that. And I don't know. I've stopped trying to explain that. I just declaratively state, from my perspective, I saw what happened. I cried that day, like a lot of Americans did watching it unfold. I grew angry that day, like a lot of Americans did watching it unfold. And I was extremely disappointed that day watching members of my party come back into session and to pick up where they left off, trying to disenfranchise millions of people in my community because they didn't like the way we voted. And that for me will always stand out as one of the lowest moments in my life as a citizen, because I felt utterly helpless in the sense that the folks, I was, just shocked that Americans would do this, but then even more shocked and disappointed that leaders who are supposed to be leaders in that moment just didn't. They didn't leave.
Well, and to me, I remember the last time I felt that sick to my stomach was watching 9/11. And this was actually worse to me because this was done from within.
Yeah.
This wasn't a foreign actor. This wasn't an enemy of the United States of America. This was the United States of America doing this to itself. And that was so hard for me to rationalize and reconcile watching it happen. It's like our citizens are Osama bin Laden's got nothing on what our own people do to ourselves.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we seem to be pretty damn good at that. Unfortunately. So I want to shift a little bit now as we wind up our conversation to some fun stuff. You are without a doubt the man when it comes to country music, at least in the circles I run in. So I always use my little encyclopedia and reference point. I'll go online. I'm like, okay, has Kurt said anything about who are the leading country music players out there? Well, I had the great fortune, folks, of getting introduced to Tim McGraw, who I actually admired and loved a lot before. I love his music. I actually do really like his music. But I really love his commercials, and I just kind of gravitated. And out of the blue, my boy calls me up. Kurt calls up and say, "Hey, there's this opportunity to participate in a little fun video that Tim was putting together," and we did that. It was great fun, and that aired during the Super Bowl. When did that aired? What was
God,
that?
I don't even remember now. That's the thing about COVID, time blends together.
Yeah.
And I can't even keep track of when this shit happened. My God.
I forgot with it, but it was just a lot of fun to do. And I took note of the fact, and I gave you kudos, even though you probably had nothing to do with it, not to put too much in your back. I told people, yeah, that's the Kurt Bardella effect. When Garth Brooks sang at the inauguration, I was surprised at the shit he got for that from some quarters.
Because
I thought he was very moving in his rendition and his presentation. It was it was a very powerful and very poignant moment in those celebrations, and it would just capture Garth does. I mean, he's known for that.
Yeah.
He captured it. And you had written a piece, and I was looking to pull it up because I did hear about it. You had written a piece a while ago about country music and the impact it can have mm-hmm. on the here and now, where we are right now.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that and sort of the soothing, because there is a soothing nature to it. But it also kind of reflects some of the angst and anxieties that we experience in our daily lives. You know, yeah, definitely. I came on the front porch and I kicked my dog again, kind of narratives, right? Only this time the dog bit back. You know, you just kind of go through these great little stories that really are miniature moments in life.
That's the thing about, you know, country music that I've always gravitated towards. Country music is the soundtrack to our lives, mm-hmm. whether it's your first kiss or your breakup, whether it's your wedding or you lost your job, you know, just the everyday human things that we all go for. I think country music best captures that in a storytelling way than any genre of music at all. And one of the things that surprised me as I started becoming a part of the country music national community was how many songs and artists really do speak to the things that we're going through. Mm-hmm. During COVID, artist named Luke Combs put out this great song called 6 Feet Apart, that we never imagined that we would live in a world where we would
6 feet apart. Right.
Literally measure our experience by how far apart we were from one another. I think about after the Vegas shooting, the worst mass shooting in the history of our country, at a country music festival, Maren Morris and Vince Gill put out a song called Dear Hate, talking about that experience. My man Tim McGraw has a beautiful song called Humble and Kind that I think about often. First, all the things that are wrong in our country and all the divisiveness, we also have to have a conversation about forgiveness and about seeing the best in one another and healing. And I know a lot of people who aren't country music fans, they don't necessarily think about country music having a social impact or having a political bent, or they associate country music with the conservative right more than the progressive left. And what I have found is it's much more balanced than that. And there are topics that these artists are willing to talk about very openly and freely. We just had an artist, one half of the duo, the Brothers Osborne, who are very popular in a country music format. TJ Osborne, became the first male artist to come out as a gay man.
That's a big deal.
which is something you could never imagine
right.
in this format going over well.
Right.
But he was met with, love and acceptance and I know him and I've talked to him about this, and he was very scared about doing this, but he wanted to live his truth and not have to hide it. And he wanted that. He wanted to be honest, because that's also part of his music. And when you now experience their music, you see it through a different lens because right. of having that context. Even just racial injustice. One of the greatest moments of the Grammys that we just had recently was an artist named Mickey Guyton playing a song called Black Like Me.
Mm-hmm.
And, Mickey is, was, I think, the first female Black country music artist to ever get nominated for a Grammy.
Yeah.
And so it was a historic moment just to see her on that stage.
It was, because you often think about when it comes to Black folks in country music, the first name everyone throws out, and largely the only name they throw, is Charlie Pride, right? And so,
right.
So now you've got this generation that's forming around us where it says, and I think your point about coming out as a gay person in the country music genre speaks to how that culturally, musically, and otherwise, it's changing. And again, country music is reflecting that change. I mean, and right. they're stepping into it and leaning into it in a way that is very telling. While you were talking, I was looking for it. I found the piece that you wrote. It was actually because I wanted to make sure I had it right in front of me. It was an op-ed you did for the Los Angeles Times, Garth Brooks, bringing some unity through country music, and you go on and talk about how this style of music, again, as you said, it's sort of the narrative, the story of the music to our lives that tells that part of that story. You talk about it not just representing those of you inside the country music bubble, you know, those who mm-hmm. kind of live and breathe the music in the industry, but at this particular inflection point in our history and culture, his song reminds us that no matter what our differences are, we are one country nation. And I thought that was really a really impactful statement, because when I think about that and I think about the conversation we just had, what we touched on, the challenges that your community, my community are facing, trying to deal with the hatred out there, the challenges of recovering from illness and COVID and all of that, we are still one nation. We're still one country. We are one country nation.
That's right.
And that those stories are also reflected in the country music space. They're talking about, as you just gave a couple examples, you know, dealing with 6 feet apart, dealing with coming out, dealing with my race and my culture. Mm-hmm. How much of that do you think really will kind of turn some corners for future generations, as country music did for previous generations, having to embrace the changes of the 1930s and 40s, the post-war era of the 1960s. Country music has kind of been that thread. All these other genres have been there, not taken away from any other, because I love my my dance music. I like to dance through life. But country music has been one of those things that's kind of been there. It's sort of that thread that keeps weaving through these stories.
Yeah, well, I think about some, you know, when you think about like feminist icons, you think of Dolly Parton Loretta Lynn, Coal Miner's Daughter. You know, obviously the late, great Charlie Pride and everything that he represents and symbolizes. You think about, you know, Johnny Cash and Folsom City Blues, and you know, there's throughout the history of our country and different inflection points, and whether it's civil rights, whether it's, you know, just blue collar, you know, America trying to grapple with troubling economic times, whether it's what we're going through right now, 9/11, like there is a song for every season, and there is an artist that has always transcended the genre to speak to a broader segment of the American population. That's why I thought it was so important to have a country music artist at the inauguration, to have that part, you know, so that no matter who you voted for in that election, there was someone on that stage that you could identify with, mm-hmm. and that was representing you. And I thought that was core to the Biden brand overall. You know, one of the ways that country music, I think, is unique is when you look at where the friction exists in our society right now, particularly with people of color, communities of color, and white people, country music is in a position to uniquely speak to and influence that audience. And one of the areas where I think that's going to be most powerful is the issue of the Confederate flag. How I can't tell you how many times I went to probably 70 shows in 2019. Mm-hmm. That's 70 tailgates. That's a lot of freaking pickup trucks, man. Okay. And I saw a lot of Confederate flags.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a lot of Confederate flags.
But here we are 2 years later now, and Confederate flags have been banned from venues.
Yeah.
Artists who have been pictured with the Confederate flag 7-8 years ago are now speaking out against it, saying that they acknowledge, I didn't understand what it meant. I didn't understand the full context. I apologize to anyone I've ever offended, and I will no longer endorse mm-hmm. any image with the Confederate flag. It's like they're talking to an audience that needs to hear it, and they don't need to hear it from you or me. They need to hear it from people who look like them.
Right, right.
And that's an area where I think the country music community can really lead and help change things.
Well, you've been in voice inside that community. You've been a strong advocate for sure. I've watched you bring country music to Morning Joe. and I've loved every moment of that. And I watch you bring it to me in a real way. I got a chance to salute having a beer with Tim McGraw's video, which was, and give my best to Tim. I love that brother. I'd love to meet him someday.
We'll make that happen.
Yeah, he's just one of those guys. You know, he's on my bucket list. What can I say? He's just one of those guys that I just get such a good down to earth vibe from him, and I just love watching him and listening to him, and particularly hearing him sing his music. But you've done it in so many ways, Kurt. You've been a voice out there in social media and politics, and it's really nice having you take a time or two to spend with us here at the podcast, man, and bringing those insights. And I just want to say, from my community to yours, we got your back. We stand as Americans against the hate that your community and Asians all around the country are experiencing right now. And the only way we will defeat it is if we do it together, you know, as a country nation, right?
Amen to that, brother. Well, I look forward to the day where we can get together, have a beer or two or three.
Yes, indeed, four or five.
But I appreciate you having me on, man. I miss seeing you.
Yeah, same here, my friend. I'll be watching you for you on the air. We'll probably wind up on TV together at some point. Yeah,
probably.
Yep. But he is the creator and publisher of the country music media platform, The Morning Hangover, as well as a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors and an NBC News Think, LA Times, and USA Today contributor, Kurt Bardella. It's a great joy having you on. I really appreciate it. And folks, that does it for this time together. But you know me, I'll be back, right? And when I do, I hope you're there. Don't forget to download us, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast on. Do that like thing. It works. It just does. It makes me feel all yummy inside, and it makes you feel good too. And until then, do what I always ask, you know, take care of yourselves, love your family, behave, wear the damn mask. And now we'll add, get the vaccine. Okay. So just real clear here. Until then, y'all take care.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.